As Marco and Laura bear down on the Gulf Coast, the governor issues disaster declarations, the latest on tropical storms and what to expect today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Our conversation with the meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service covering Houston and Galveston on possible evacuations plus impacts already to the energy sector. The grand old party's turn, how Texas Republicans are gearing up for the national convention this week. And remaking the political maps of Texas, what lessons can be learned from rethinking the past? Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Monday, the 24th day of August. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Governor Greg Abbott has declared a state of disaster in 23 coastal counties as two tropical storms advanced toward the Gulf of Mexico over the weekend. One of the two systems, what was once named Hurricane Marco, has been downgraded from hurricane status. Meanwhile, a second storm, what's now called Tropical Storm Laura, is expected to intensify as it approaches the Gulf. But hurricane models are imprecise, and predictions that Laura would make landfall Thursday somewhere between the upper coast of East Texas and Louisiana have been adjusted and readjusted over the past 24 hours, and more changes to their track and intensity predictions are likely as we approach Tuesday. But rain and wind effects still promise to be a serious threat, and it's Tropical Storm Marco that seems to pose a more immediate impact to the Gulf. For the latest, we turn to an expert on such events. Jeffrey Evans is a meteorologist in charge with the National Weather Service in the Houston-Galveston area. Mr. Evans, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Do I have that right, that Marco poses the more immediate threat?
Well, I mean, it's the more immediate storm for us, but the threat is diminishing quite quickly with Marco as it pretty much falls apart. So really, we'll be talking more remnants of Marco here over the next day or so, as really Laura is the storm to focus on, and Laura will be the storm of record as it comes up in the northwestern Gulf over the next 48 hours.
Very interesting. Now, I was looking at a map, it appeared that the remnants of Marco, or at least Tropical Storm Marco as it currently is, was somewhere sort of south of Mississippi and Alabama, right? What are you expecting over the next several hours?
Yeah, Marco's center is still there, just south of southeastern Louisiana, kind of just off the central Gulf Coast area. Most of the thunderstorms are displaced off to the northeast across the Florida Panhandle, southern Alabama. We do expect Marco to continue a westward drift with whatever remnants of that low will be. We do expect it to go down to a tropical depression here over the next 24 hours or so. So as I was saying, Marco, for the most part, especially for Texas, is really not going to have any impacts at all.
However, we have that 1-2 punch of Laura, which is following Marco into the Gulf. What's the biggest concern there, and what are your predictions saying currently?
Laura is definitely a storm to watch, and it's a storm to be concerned with. It's probably the most threatening hurricane we've had in the upper Texas coast since Ike in 2008. We have not had a hurricane landfall in the upper Texas coast since Ike. So we've gone 12 years now without one. Looks like Laura is south of Cuba now. It's still a tropical storm and somewhat disorganized. We expect that to change as it gets away from Cuba over the next 24 hours and into the middle of the Gulf of Mexico tomorrow. We expect rapid intensification. We could see a strong Category 2 or a Category 3 hurricane approaching the Texas-Louisiana border area, somewhere between Galveston Island and, say, Vermilion Bay, Louisiana. Somewhere in that range here, we're looking for a landfall Wednesday night, early Thursday morning.
Not since Ike. Well, that stopped me dead in my tracks, and I think it would for a lot of our listeners right now. What is the biggest threat posed by Laura, and why is it expected to intensify?
Well, the waters are very warm. It's going to get into an environment that's going to be very favorable for intensification as it gets out over the central Gulf of Mexico. You know, Laura is a fast-moving storm, so it's not going to be like a Harvey. It's not, or a Melda, which is, we don't expect this to stall, but it's going to bring your traditional hurricane risk. There's going to be storm surge, perhaps very significant surge along the coastal areas. Very strong winds, tornadoes, heavy rain. So it's all within play with Laura. The key is going to be where Laura makes landfall, and some of the guidance continues to show anywhere from, you know, near or just east of Galveston Bay all the way into southwestern Louisiana. Whether or not you're on the left or right side of a hurricane makes a fairly big difference with impact. So if the storm does move into Louisiana, we would expect less impacts. However, we do not expect that right turn to occur until it gets very close to landfall. So we're looking at 18 hours or so before landfall, before this storm may turn, if it turns, which means if it doesn't turn, people would not have time to act.
So getting back to that timeline, you mentioned 18 hours. Is that 18 hours before it turns or 18 hours before landfall proper? And what are you predicting now on landfall?
Right now, the landfall is predicted to occur somewhere near the Texas-Louisiana border, maybe just east of the border area. That's just a perfect forecast. Like I said, there's still the uncertainty cone, and there's still some of the guidance that brings it as far west as Galveston. So it's a storm we really have to pay attention to. We really have to watch. I wouldn't be surprised to start seeing evacuation for vulnerable populations to be ordered at some point today. Hurricane watches could come up at some point today. So we're going to really have to watch this storm today and really over the next couple of days to see how it behaves.
You're not an expert in pandemic, but that would seem to complicate matters too, right? I mean, especially if you're talking about evacuations.
That is a concern. If you're in a vulnerable area and officials are telling you you need to go, you need to go. But that doesn't mean you need to ignore your pandemic plans, your masks, social distancing. All of those things are going to be a concern. You know, in some ways, we're going to have to handle both risks as they come at us. We can't control these things. This is nature. We just have to deal with it and the best we can.
It's a story we continue to track, and certainly Jeffrey Evans does too. He is a meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service for the Houston-Galveston area. Jeffrey, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Last week, the Democrats hosted their national convention, formally nominating former Vice President Joe Biden, along with his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, to take on President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence in November. While the Democrats had an all-virtual convention, Republicans will have a scaled-back in-person component. KERA's Rachel Osier Lindley has more on this week's convention and what Texas Republicans are saying about the race for the White House.
2020 campaign watchers gave the Democrats mostly positive reviews for their national convention last week.
Part of what any convention needs to do is to bring everybody in the family back together after a contentious primary and caucus season.
Rebecca Dean chairs the political science department at UT Arlington.
And the Democrats achieved that very successfully.
This week, Dean says, the Republicans don't have as heavy a lift.
Conventions are supposed to unify the base, also to introduce the voters to the nominee. And President Trump doesn't have to unify his base, nor does he have to introduce himself to the nation, not only because he's the incumbent president, but also because people have pretty firmly solidified views of the president.
Like Desiree Brown, an RNC delegate from Plano and a Collin County young Republican.
When Donald Trump started hinting that he wanted to run, I immediately jumped on board and backed him from day one.
Originally, the RNC was supposed to bring together more than 2,500 delegates, including 155 from Texas, in Charlotte, North Carolina. With COVID-19, that's been scaled back to just 6 per state or territory. Brown, who works for a financial services company, is one of the 149 Texas delegates who'll be watching from home.
And it's still exciting, but it's definitely disappointing that I'm still just going to be watching it from my living room instead of being there in person.
Brown grew up in Midland and says she's especially happy with the energy industry and economy under President Trump. And she's looking forward to the speeches this week.
I hope that the message from all of the Republican speakers stays positive. The biggest thing that I didn't see out of the DNC, they just did not talk a whole lot about what Joe Biden will do or what his plans are. It was just constantly what Donald Trump has done negatively.
The Republican National Convention will feature 4 nights of speakers starting this evening. Just 2 Texans are on the schedule. Anti-abortion advocate Abby Johnson, who once worked for Planned Parenthood, and first-term Congressman Dan Crenshaw, a former Navy SEAL who now represents Texas's 2nd Congressional District. That includes parts of Houston.
Congressman Crenshaw is a very thoughtful guy.
Dr. Robin Armstrong is the GOP National Committeeman from Texas.
She'll bring a Texas perspective. We're a sort of a live free or die kind of state. So I think he'll represent us well.
Last week, Texas Democrats had expressed frustration that not more Texans were featured prominently on the DNC stage. At the RNC, Armstrong says,
our time on the stage is not the most important thing. The RNC has invested, you know, lots of resources in the state of Texas. We're a very, very important state. The Republican National Committee certainly recognizes that.
The most important thing Armstrong hopes people do notice, if they watch?
We don't have a lot of politicians who are speaking. I mean, we really want to tell the story about everyday Americans and how this president has benefited their lives.
As for the battle over Texas's 38 electoral votes, Trump and Biden are about even in polls of Lone Star voters. But Armstrong says Democrats shouldn't get their hopes up. A Democrat hasn't won the state since Jimmy Carter did in 1976, and he doesn't think that'll happen this year either.
We're certainly going to win the state of Texas by a large margin, but it's important for us to run up the score in the state of Texas and make sure that we win by hopefully double digits this time, and so we could win state House seats and win state Senate seats and win two congressional seats back that we lost in 2018. And so that's our focus.
While Armstrong says Republicans aren't scaling back their effort to keep Texas red, he's well plugged into the changes they have made to the convention because of the COVID-19 pandemic. He's a practicing doctor of internal medicine in South Texas and one of the people on site in Charlotte this week. Armstrong says everyone who will be at the convention will have been tested for COVID multiple times. Attendees will also be practicing social distancing, he says, and wearing masks. I'm Rachel Osier Lindley in Dallas.
Michael Marks in for Wells Dunbar, monitoring social media on this Monday. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, David. Texans are talking about news out of Wisconsin that broke yesterday. Another instance of police officers shooting an unarmed black man. Video on social media shows officers from the Kenosha Police Department shoot Jacob Blake multiple times in the back. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that Blake is alive, but in critical condition at the moment. Not totally clear what led to him being shot by police, but the Kenosha News reports he was trying to break up an altercation that police had responded to. The video shows Blake walking around to the driver's side of his car while police officers follow him, one of the officers tugging at Blake's shirt as he opens the door and then shooting him in the back. Protests in the city stretched through the early morning, reaction pouring in from all over, including Texas. In Houston, Jen Hunter tweets, I'm really praying for Jacob Blake and his family this morning, in front of his children at that, referencing that Blake's sons were in the car when police shot him.
Of course, we would love to hear from you, Texas, on this story or anything else that's making news today. Reach out to us. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Michael Marks, back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Two private religious schools in South Texas are mounting a legal challenge against Cameron County, saying that the county's order to delay school opening is an attack on religious liberty. The Monitor in McAllen reports that Plano-based law firm First Liberty Institute has threatened to sue Cameron County over its emergency order issued August 10th. Now, that order requires schools to delay in-person classes in public and private K-12 schools until after September 28th. The firm is representing Laguna Madre Christian Academy in Laguna Vista and Calvary Christian School of Excellence in Harlingen. Those schools are planning to begin face-to-face learning August 31st and September 8th, respectively. An attorney with First Liberty says that the order is unlawful and violates the school's religious freedoms. County Judge Eddie Trevino Jr. says that's a mischaracterization of the order since it applies to both secular and non-secular private schools. A developing story and one we continue to watch here at The Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Before the pandemic, before life changed, as we all know it, many politicians and experts still viewed 2020 as a year that could alter the direction of the country for the next decade, not just because it's an election year. It's also a census year. And early next year, Texas politicians in charge of redistricting will use those census results to once again chop up the map and draw boundaries in districts based on these results, with definite and obvious political implications. But Texas's political maps have an unusually controversial and contentious past. What can we learn from it? For more, we're joined by a former Texan who knows the state and its redistricting issues. Michael Lee focuses on redistricting, voting rights, and elections for the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Help us connect the dots here. How much do redistricting maps tend to change from decade to decade? Either way, for some people, they could have completely different politicians representing them the next time they go to the ballot box after November, right?
Right, absolutely. You know, and maps, every 10 years after the census, legislative and congressional maps around the country are redrawn to make sure that districts are equally populated and comply with other requirements of law, including the Voting Rights Act. Texas tends to see bigger changes than most states because Texas is a fast-growing state. It's estimated to have added about 4.3 million people since the last census, the fastest-growing state in the country. And as a result, it's going to gain three new congressional seats. But a lot of that's going to depend on the census. Unlike other states, Texas has invested no money in census outreach. California, by contrast, has spent over $100 million. And not surprisingly, response rates are lagging in Texas, and the pandemic doesn't help. And it doesn't help that the Trump administration has said that it's going to try to rush the census to completion, even though experts have said that that's foolish and will only result in an undercount. And that could be a real disaster for Texas.
Once upon a time, I knew a person who was involved with a challenge to Texas's redistricting maps, and he talked about packing and cracking. Have you ever heard of packing and cracking?
Packing and cracking are two of the big tools to rig maps in favor of one party or the other. And basically what it means is that you cram people either into a district or you split them up in order to adjust how districts perform. And oftentimes it's people of color who are packed and cracked. You know, you'll stick, for example, African-Americans and Latinos into one district so that they, instead of, you know, spreading them out, you know, among other districts, sometimes it's Democrats, sometimes it's Republicans, but those are two basic tools. Because what you want to do is make sure that districts perform the way that you want them to perform, and that means adjusting the number of people who support you or don't support you. So those are two of the colloquial terms that we use to describe that process.
Which brings us perhaps to the process in the 2010s when Texas was in court arguing the validity of its 2011 redistricting maps. Basically, the process, Texas said, was fair. But if you're talking about people of color being systematically packed or cracked into different groups, are you not violating racial discrimination laws in the process?
So for 5 decades now, Texas has had every map that it's drawn challenged in court. And every decade, at least parts of those maps have been struck down for discriminating against communities of color. That was true when Democrats were drawing the maps, and it's been true since Republicans are in charge of the map drawing pen. And last decade was an especially bad decade. Texas grew by about 4.2 million people, two-thirds of whom were Latino and more than 90% of whom were non-white. Yet the Republican-controlled Texas legislature created no new electoral opportunities for Black or Latino communities, and that resulted in a flurry of litigation in two courts and the maps being found intentionally discriminatory and partially redrawn by another court. At last, from the standpoint of communities of color, the fixes were only partial, but absolutely.
So just to be clear, it's not the gerrymandering that is problematic. That's not illegal, as I understand it. What is illegal is if you're doing this to dilute the power of a particular racial group. Is that right? You're discriminating against that group.
The Supreme Court has said that partisan gerrymandering is out of bounds for federal courts. It's a political question that federal courts can't consider. But it has not said that about racial gerrymandering and drawing maps to discriminate against racial minorities, which still exist. And in places like Texas is oftentimes the means through which you achieve political advantage for either for Democrats or Republicans. And so last decade, the maps in Texas were not challenged on political grounds. They were challenged on the grounds that they discriminated against Latino communities and Black communities and Asian communities. And that resulted in the maps being partially redrawn. There also was some political gerrymandering in the Texas maps, particularly in Austin, which is a very cohesive unit divided up among six different congressional districts.
So I guess my question for you at this juncture would be, what could we learn from our past experience that could make this redistricting process truer to the ideal of representative democracy?
Well, one big lesson from Texas redistricting is that it is possible when gerrymandering to get too cute and too greedy, so that instead of a gerrymander, you end up with a so-called dummy mander. And that's what happened both in Austin and North Texas. In Austin, Republicans split the city up among six districts. Five of them were intended to be safe Republican seats. But yet Austin has grown so fast and has become so much more diverse that suddenly a lot of those once safe seats are now very competitive for Democrats. And if Republicans had simply done what would have been wiser and create like an Austin-based district, they wouldn't be competing in so many different congressional seats. But they got a little greedy and as a result did a dummy mander.
Do you expect things to change next year? Or does that depend on political outcomes too?
One big change could be if Democrats have a seat at the table. In 2011, Republicans controlled both houses of the legislature and the governor's mansion. If Democrats are able to win back the state house, they would have the ability to block bad congressional maps because the process would deadlock, and that would throw the process in for drawing congressional maps to a court. And we know from experience that courts, they don't necessarily draw the perfect map, but they don't draw maps that are wildly biased in favor of one party or the other, and they're much more responsive to the interests and concerns of communities of color. So that could be a huge change if Democrats are able to pick up the nine seats they need to win back the Texas House.
We've been talking about redistricting challenges in Texas with Michael Lee. He focuses on redistricting voting rights and elections for the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law and spent a considerable amount of his time in Texas, too. Professor Lee, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time with safety in mind.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy is testifying before the U.S. House Oversight Committee this morning. The hearing comes in response to growing concerns that operational changes he enacted, but has since halted, could hinder the ability of the Postal Service to handle a surge in mail-in ballots and continue serving rural areas. Two Texas Republicans sit on the committee, including Congressman Michael Cloud of Victoria. Cloud was one of 149 GOP House members to vote against legislation to infuse USPS with $25 billion in relief funding. Speaking on the House floor Saturday, he called the bill a distraction.
Today's effort is yet another smokescreen, another conspiracy theory foisted upon the American people to distract us from the real problems facing the American people.
The other Texan who's a member of the panel is Congressman Chip Roy of Austin. The U.S. Coast Guard is no longer searching for two crew members who went missing following an explosion and fire in Corpus Christi. The bodies of two others were recovered Saturday. Texas Public Radio's Jerry Clayton reports.
The incident occurred early Friday when a dredging vessel struck a propane pipeline in the port of Corpus Christi. The resulting explosion and fire caused the vessel to break apart and sink. Six people were taken to the hospital with injuries. A total of 18 crew members were on the barge. Two boats from the U.S. Coast Guard and Port of Corpus Christi Police Department, as well as a Coast Guard helicopter, were involved in the search.
Jerry Clayton reporting. As tropical storms Marco and Laura threaten communities along the Gulf Coast this week, Houston is marking 3 years since Hurricane Harvey made landfall in Texas. As Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports, city officials are commemorating the anniversary with a week of virtual events, which begins today.
The city's Climate Week begins with an opening session called Making Houston the Renewable Energy Capital of the World. Other sessions throughout the week will include Taking the Car Out of Carbon Emissions and Texas Tough, bringing EVs or electric vehicles to truck-loving Texas. There will also be several speakers like leaders from Google and Tesla, as well as Marvin Odom, the former president of Shell Oil. Some meteorologists say it's likely climate change caused Hurricane Harvey to be more severe. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Governor Greg Abbott says an emergency special election for Texas Senate District 30 will be held September 29th. Republican Pat Fallon is vacating the North Texas seat to run for the congressional district previously represented by National Intelligence Director John Ratcliffe. The filing deadline for candidates is this Friday. I'm Lauren Tarrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, students are taught about local products and nutrition to make smarter choices about eating. More at farmfreshfriday.org.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As the energy industry continues to suffer from the blow dealt by the coronavirus pandemic, well, it looks like things may get worse before they get better for the energy industry, at least. We're looping back to a story we started out our broadcast today with, the 1-2 punch of storms Marco and Laura headed toward the Gulf Coast, complicating things for an industry that's already seen significant losses since the beginning of this year. Marco in particular could shake things up for Texas's energy producers. That storm is expected to head westward along the coastline toward Texas after initially making landfall over Louisiana. It's something that Energy Insider Matt Smith is certainly keeping an eye on. He's Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back to the Standard.
Thank you, David.
What a year, huh? I mean, this is an unusual situation to be sure, but we're looking at two storm systems, back-to-back landfalls possibly. Are we already seeing any impact from Marco as it closes in on the coast?
Yeah, so we already are. We're seeing 58% of Gulf of Mexico oil production, which is just over a million barrels a day, being shut in ahead of the storm making landfall. And about 45% of natural gas production offshore has been shut in as well. Given the path of Tropical Storm Laura, which is essentially, as you mentioned, is kind of doing that 1-2 punch and following in after Marco. Laura is currently expected to make landfall on Thursday morning on the Texas/Louisiana border. And so the percentage of production offline offshore there is likely to only rise in the coming days. So we're seeing the production side of things impacted already. But there's also signs of gasoline demand spiking in Louisiana ahead of the storm because you're seeing some panic buying and some are preparing to leave the area and get out of the storm's path. So a couple of influences already showing up there ahead of the storm.
Well, so what are the experts telling you about the most likely impacts to energy and the energy business from Marco and Laura? I mean, how could these impacts change based on these paths, which apparently have been changing by the hour or over the past several 24 hours, certainly?
Yeah, so, you know, we've got that offshore production offline. That production is prevalent more in the sort of eastern part of the Gulf, hence why that's been taken offline with the path of Marco, while refineries are more prevalent in the western part of the Gulf, i.e. in Texas there. So should we see Marco peeling west along the coast, and should Laura strengthen and head towards Texas, then we could see refineries being shut in. And in fact, there's already talk. We've had rumors of Motiva at Port Arthur there, their refinery. That's the largest refinery in the U.S. It has a capacity of about 600,000 barrels a day. There's talk of that being shut in ahead of these storms coming through. So should we see Laura kind of edge a little bit west rather than hitting that kind of border there, we could see those refineries impacted.
Well, let's pull back for just a moment and try to get a sense of what the macro picture could be here. I imagine that there are some people sort of calculating worst case scenarios and the like. But as you think about supply and demand, when you have production cutbacks, what does that do to the overall picture when it comes to prices and the industry at large?
So you typically have the reaction where you see gasoline
prices and gasoline demand kind of spiking, one because of that panic buying, but also because of the refineries going offline, so that there's less supply. So you typically see gasoline prices being pushed higher, and that's what we're seeing today so far. We're seeing them outperforming oil prices. On the flip side of that, you tend to see lower oil demand because these refineries aren't consuming that oil, and so the prices are pushed down. As long as those refinery outages outweigh the production that is taken offline. So typically it's more bullish for gasoline and more bearish for oil prices.
Is this a short-term thing, or is this potentially a long-term issue for the energy industry? I mean, if you have a lot of facilities pushed offline, if you have damage on top of that, well, how do you see it playing out, Matt?
Well, we've seen just in recent years, you know, even with Hurricane Harvey coming through, where you see a lot of damage to these refineries, these guys are able to get in there and fix them, and they tend to come back much better and much faster than people expect. So the impact of these storms is going to be a transitory thing, even if they are worse than expected. All that said, we're having a record hurricane season so far this year. It feels as if there is more activity, you know, more volatile weather. And so that's something that the industry is going to have to get used to dealing with going forward here, it seems.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Charlotte Martin. I live in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm wearing a mask everywhere I go. Well, at 73, it is difficult. I've tried several different kinds of masks because I also wear glasses, and they always steam up. So one of my favorite things is grocery shopping, and I can't see the produce or I can't see the prices so well because they get all fogged up. You have a great San Antonio Public Library. Wonderful. And when this started, they put these two huge signs outside the library that have step one, step two, what you do to get your books. And what I've seen is I have seen that people park in those first two or three slots so that they can read the signs, call the number in the library and bring your book, put it on a table outside, and you pick them up and you go on your way. Well, I parked in my regular first slot and call the number, and of course they go and get the books wherever they have them stored. All the other times that I went, I noticed that people stay in their cars. I was sitting there waiting, and I noticed a man walk up the steps and stand very close to the desk. And being probably the semi-nervous person that I am, I kept thinking, what if that person grabs my books? And so with my worry, I decided to get out of my car and to stand at the bottom of the steps, which I did. And I was taking side glances at this man with the black mask on because I thought, he looks like he's so ready to get the books. He's going to get the first ones that come out. What if they're mine? When the books came out, the librarian brought out two stacks of books. I didn't quite notice that. So when he quickly got a stack and started coming down the steps, I just said, sir, are you sure those are yours? Are you sure? And he slowly turned and he said, do you know who you're talking to? And I thought, oh no, I'm going to get in a confrontation. I didn't say anything. And after a little while, he repeated it. Do you know who you're talking to? And I promise you, I saw the security guard squirm. But eventually I recognized him. And so I looked at the security guard and I said, it's my son. You know, and David was, Mom, how could you not recognize, you know, the person you gave birth to 44 years ago? And I said, well, sweetie, you had on that mask. I mean, that black mask and black shirt. And I just didn't recognize you. So I told this story to my family. Then I told it to my mother-in-law, who's 95. And she told me, you need to send that into Reader's Digest. And I thought, Reader's Digest, I'm sending it in. I'm going to send it into the Texas Standard. This is Charlotte Martin from San Antonio, Texas. I love my library. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
We're collecting stories from Texas about life in a time when we're required to wear masks for many public interactions, and we'd like to hear your story. Does wearing a mask pose any particular challenges to you? Have you chosen one with a pattern or design you think really speaks to your personality? Reach out to us on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Thousands of college students across the Lone Star State are heading back to class today. And with the pandemic, it's going to be a very different experience for many. One student, David Keeling, is a current intern at Houston Public Media, and he put together a report on how his return to Prairie View A&M is being affected by not only COVID-19, but also a renewed focus on racial justice.
When Prairie View students head down University Boulevard, returning to the main campus this semester, there see a new street mural. In bright yellow letters, Black Lives Matter is painted on the roadway. It's just one of the several changes on campus this year. As a historically Black university, Prairie View A&M is opening a new center to help students connect around racial issues like police brutality that have been in the news all summer.
It's easy for a campus to become so preoccupied with preparing for the fall that it loses sight of the fact that it has an educational obligation to respond to what's happening in our streets around social justice.
That's Dr. Timothy Sams. He's the Vice President of Student Affairs. He helps students see the university is stepping up its mission to spread awareness of justice in the Black community.
Students can expect this fall a racial and social justice center, a center on our campus that has a laser-like focus on these kinds of issues that are being raised in our streets today.
Part of the mission at Prairie View is to create a safe environment for students of color to learn. And this year, professors are also trying to create a safe environment from COVID-19.
Whether they live on campus or not, every student would proceed this fall with a great deal of caution and care for not just themselves, but for one another.
This fall, administrators gave professors a lot of flexibility to teach in person or online. Communication professor Derek Blackwell decided to do all of his classes virtually. He believes there are too many risks with teaching face-to-face, and he wants his students to learn in the safest climate possible.
I've had to have an added flexibility just because I know that people are working under unusual circumstances that are kind of beyond their control and are usually not ideal circumstances.
Blackwell knows many of his students are struggling in different ways because of COVID-19, including the toll on their mental health. Houston Public Media surveyed 33 Prairie View students and found that all of them agree about returning to in-person classes. More than 90% of students who responded said they feel virtual learning is safer, and some are wondering about the missed messages from the school since Prairie View held a virtual commencement ceremony this summer. Some aren't confident other students will actually follow the protocol for masks. Jasmine Charlie is a communications student returning for her senior year. She also mentors incoming freshmen.
Prairie View is known for, one, having so many various organizations and events, and there's always something going on campus. So I think my biggest worry is how are we still going to get that college experience and feeling while we are social distancing.
Charlie plans to practice social distancing and be cautious about where she goes on campus. She still plans on attending events if they enhance her learning and her future career. She's looking forward to reconnecting with fellow Panthers at the historically black college after a summer made more difficult by the virus and the murder of former Houstonian George Floyd and the massive protests that followed.
Though we are in the pandemic and everything is going on, I just feel like what better place to be than an HBCU with people who are, you know, like you, and being able to go through these moments in history together.
Charlie believes that allows her and other students of color to stay rooted and not feel alone. In Houston, I'm David Killing.
It has the highest crime rate of any military facility in the U.S., and it's located in Texas. What's happening at Fort Hood? Closer look as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. While Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen's killing gained national and worldwide attention earlier this year, several other suspected homicides of soldiers at or near Fort Hood near Killeen, Texas, have added to concerns about safety and justice on one of the world's largest military posts. Lawmakers and loved ones are now demanding reforms, but violent crime on Fort Hood has been a concern even before 2020. So why the attention this year and why now for reforms? Rose Thayer has been writing about this for Stars and Stripes. Her latest article examines these questions and delves into why Fort Hood is considered the Army's most crime-ridden post. Rose joins us now from Austin. Thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
When we say Fort Hood is the Army's most crime-ridden base, what kind of crimes are we talking about here, and what about the history of violence there?
We're talking about all sorts of crimes. Earlier this year, the Secretary of the Army came to Fort Hood, and he brought the statistic up that Fort Hood had the highest numbers. And so last week, he released exactly what he was looking at when he said that. And according to, you know, his data, he compared Fort Hood to two other installations with similar populations. Fort Hood has about 36,000 soldiers. Fort Bragg has about 10,000 more. And Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington has about 10,000 less. But Fort Hood still has higher numbers of both violent crimes and nonviolent crimes.
But this year, 2020, you write, has been an unusually deadly year, correct?
Yes, that's correct. At Fort Hood this year, there have been 5 soldiers who have died by homicide. And there have been 2 soldiers who were separated within the last 6 months who also died by homicide. And then, unfortunately, there's been 2 soldiers who have been charged with murder.
In fact, most recently, another soldier was reported missing. I believe that was last week, though no foul play has been associated with the disappearance. It sort of adds into this narrative that's getting a lot of attention. Now, Fort Hood, we should note, is next to Killeen, Texas. Are there reasons to believe that there's something happening in the culture at Fort Hood that might be tied to these incidents of violence and violent crimes?
You know, when I spoke to the attorney for the Guyenne family, her name is Natalie Quam, and she's had other clients that have served at Fort Hood. And she said from listening to her clients speak, particularly about sexual harassment and assault, that there seems to be this don't talk about what you see sort of mentality, sort of, you know, ignore it, ignore the problem, and it's not a problem. And I think that stems from leadership. I think leadership need to take charge and say, no, this is wrong. And then people will see that there's repercussions for actions, and perhaps it will allow people to step forward and say more when they see things happening. And it will also deter those people who might be inclined to commit acts of, you know, assault against their fellow service members.
The death of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen caused public outcry, not just locally, but across the nation. And there have been calls for reform at Fort Hood. What sort of reforms are they talking about, and why did this case seem to gain so much attention?
I think it's the fact that what happened to Vanessa Guillen was so horrific. And she was, like most soldiers, she was young. So it's no surprise that people really felt what this family was feeling when they were going through, you know, the disappearance and the 2 months that it took to find Vanessa's remains. Since then, there have been several calls for reform. I think within the Army internally, there's about 4 investigations that are ongoing, the most notable being this independent review committee that the Secretary of the Army has put together. It's made up of 5 civilians, 4 of them served in the military, and they're supposed to go to Fort Hood and really understand the command climate and the culture and determine if it matches the Army's values. And so I think their report is due at the end of October, and we'll all be, you know, waiting to see what comes of that. However, there are people who think that the Army is still investigating itself, and they would like to see some sort of look at Fort Hood that doesn't involve the Army in any way. So there's a group, mainly female veterans, and there's also the Guyan family and their supporters who would like to see Congress intervene and investigate and, you know, get a better understanding of why it is at Fort Hood that this is happening and what's the root cause and what really needs to be done to make sure our soldiers are safe when they go to serve there.
Rose Thayer is a reporter for Stars and Stripes. We'll link to her story at texasstandard.org. Rose, thanks again.
Yep, thank you so much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. It's a really, really interesting story and one worth checking out. Again, we've got a link to it over at texasstandard.org, or we shall momentarily. Joining us now in monitoring social media on this Monday, it's our own Michael Marks in for Wells Dunbar, who I understand is celebrating a birthday today. Happy birthday, Wells.
Happy birthday, Wells, indeed. And David, throughout the show, we've heard about these storms in the Gulf. Marco and Laura. Before we say anything else about them, we should note that they are their trajectory is a fluid situation. Models of where the storms are going to hit, what impact they're going to have, that's all going to change. But at the moment, it looks, as we've said, like Marco's most profound effects will be felt in Louisiana and Alabama. Laura, however, could be heading towards southeast Texas as a hurricane. Maybe around Wednesday evening is what it's looking like at the moment. Officials telling folks along the Gulf Coast to get ready right now. Be ready to evacuate if you've got to. Have emergency supplies like flashlights, water, food, medicine. Make sure your critical documents are high up in waterproof containers. This tweet just coming in from Houston meteorologist and friend of the program, Matt Lanza of the website Space City Weather. He writes in part, prepare as if a major hurricane were headed toward Texas or West Louisiana, and let's hope for the best. Of course, a lot of folks living on the Gulf Coast, David, they don't need these reminders. They remember what happened with Harvey, with Imelda, with Ike. In Houston, Sarah Kress tweets, it's not fair that Laura is going to hit overnight on August 26th, which is when Harvey flooded our house exactly 3 years ago. Likewise, Abigail Mosley in Lumberton, that's in Hardin County, a little north of Beaumont. She tweets that Hurricane Laura is taking the path that Rita took, hoping everyone in the 409 and surrounding areas stay safe. And finally, David, wanted to read this tweet from Stephanie Clay in Houston, who notes that so many Texans have just recovered fully from Harvey. This will be demoralizing if Laura continues to shift more and more west on top of the economic insecurity with the pandemic. This is an additional financial hit that will make everything worse. I don't know what else you could say about it, David.
Yeah. One thing that, that struck me in our conversation earlier in the broadcast, and I'm sure a lot of listeners picked up on this too, that folks should prepare for an event from Laura, not so much from Marco, because it does seem to be petering out, but from Laura later in the week, that could be on a scale of like Hurricane Ike. They don't expect it to bring a lot of rainfall. However, storm surges and that sort of thing could be very intense. So keep it right here on this public radio station for the very latest, because you know we're keeping an eye on the weather and so are our partners all across the Lone Star State. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues over at texasstandard.org. On behalf of Michael Marks, Wells Dunbar, the rest of the Texas Standard crew, I'm David Brown, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam,
and the George Huntington family.